The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. We're at the Sloan Conference in Boston. We have an audience, and we have the godfather of stats, Bill James. So, 1975, you are getting your PhD at Kansas, and somebody says to you, it's going to take like six more years before you get it, or, and you decide, I'm going to write about baseball, that's what I want to do.
I wasn't actually getting a PhD, I was thinking about going to graduate school. I actually, I'd gotten out of the Army and I was hanging around campus for a year as trying to become a perpetual student, which I failed. But I wasn't actually a grad student.
Oh, that was Sports Illustrated from 1981 needs to correct that part, I think.
I'm sure they'll get to that.
So you decide to throw yourself into the baseball writing world. And at that point, it's all newspapers and game stories and some newspaper columns the next day, and that's it. Those are the only baseball writing other than Roger Angel and New Yorker.
There are a lot of good books. Ed Lynn had written a bunch of good baseball books. You couldn't blog in those days because
there's no internet.
Al Gore hadn't invented the internet. What I was doing is kind of like blogging, but with no internet. It's kind of, you know, I would blog to my wife, and she would be patient.
Right. So in 1977, you did your first baseball abstract, and I think you sold it for, I saw $3 and $4 as I was doing my research. Was it three or four?
Oh, you need to stop doing that research, man. I'll kill you. I think the first one sold for $3 the first year, I believe.
And you sold 75 copies.
That's right.
You sold those copies because you put an ad in the back of the Sporting News.
That's right.
And then in 1978... I have all the stats here. 1978, it went up to 325 copies.
That sounds about right.
1979, 600 copies.
Yes.
1980, 750 copies.
All right.
So now you're at the four-year mark here, and you haven't broken 1,000 copies yet. What made you keep going and thinking this was the right path?
I'll answer your question in just a second, but you realize if you go from 600 to 750 in 1978 to 1979, if you extrapolate that out to 2012, you get almost exactly where we are.
Right.
You keep the same rate of growth going.
So you never gave up?
I never gave up because, and you probably know this, the last one was never right. You know, I have never in my life finished writing a book without being so depressed and sullen that I thought, I can never do that again. This is the last book I'm ever going to write. It lasts about a week. It's like women who have babies swear they're never having another one. And then a couple of weeks later, they forget about it and you can have another baby. But I always knew that I didn't do the last one quite right. And I always thought I should have done this and I should have done that. So that was really the reason I couldn't give up on it. Is that I always thought I hadn't got it right yet.
So those first 4 years, it seemed
like... Same with babies, by the way. You never get them right.
Those first 4 years, it seemed like the thing that really... Well, a lot of things were driving you, but the main thing was basically the conventional wisdom of how people thought about baseball. You just disagreed with it in some cases. Other cases, you were like, well, why do they think that? And you just kind of kept digging and digging and digging. Is that fair?
That is fair. A lot of baseball's conventional wisdom starts to sound silly when you become 13. Of course, the things your father tells you start to sound silly too, but you have to focus. A lot of baseball's conventional wisdom sounds childish at a certain age, and you start thinking, well, maybe that's true. How do you prove that? So what I really did was to misuse my education to study not the things I was taught to study, but baseball.
Right. So the things that I grew up with, because at that point, like 1979, I'm 10 years old, I live in Massachusetts. We believed that batting average was the most important thing and home runs.
Right.
If somebody was a good fielder, we knew that because they made good fielding plays.
Right.
Like Brooks Robinson was a good fielder because there were highlights of him making good plays, and that right. made him a good fielder.
Right.
Nolan Ryan was a great pitcher because he got strikeouts.
And no hitters.
And no hitters, right. which made him important. What were some of the other misconceptions at the time?
Speed was tremendously overvalued. The minor league batting statistics were considered to be useless because, you know, it was a different game when you got to the majors. That was a big one. The baseball people had been saying for years and years that the player's prime was ages 28 to 32, which, you know, it's not even close. People used to seriously say that baseball is 75% pitching or 90% pitching. I mean, occasionally people say that even now, but they don't mean it. But they used to really believe that. That was a big one.
So you're in Kansas. Are you just like driving your friends crazy with all these theories you have? And they're like, all right, Bill, enough. I mean, I get it. Closers should be coming in here. Like, was that what was going on?
Yeah. I don't recall that I had any friends. That could be an explanation. From their standpoint, it could have been, yeah.
So in May of 1981, Sports Illustrated wrote a piece about you by Daniel Okrent. Which was long. It's six pages on the SI Vault.
Yes.
And you said that took like 2 years before they finally ran it?
Yeah, Dan wrote that piece starting in... when I got back from my honeymoon in mid-November of 1978, I had a letter from Dan Okrent saying I'd like to write something about you. And he actually came and visited me in early 1979. The piece kept getting scheduled for publication and then killed because of some controversy, and then it get rescheduled and rekilled. Sports Illustrated is a fascinating place. I mean, it's a real institution that has lots of its own rules and its own policies. The market is always chasing them. They're not chasing the market, so they always they have a lot of practices that aren't the same as any place else. And to shepherd a piece about some guy working in a factory in Kansas through all of that minefield was challenging.
So during this is May 1981 at this point, you're working on, I think, your fifth abstract. Had any team tried to hire you at this point?
No.
Reached out? They all hated you.
Well, I was working with agents. The first kind of professional people who contacted me were agents, which started in November of 79.
Right. And this is interesting. In that piece, you had something about the Carney Lansford Fred Lynn trade.
Right.
Which Fred Lynn was my favorite Red Sox player. He had gotten traded to the Angels. And Carney Lansford was a third baseman who was coming to the Red Sox. And you predicted that Fred Lynn, his production was going to go way down, and that you saw him hitting between 275 and 285 with between 18 and 25 homers a year, and it was exactly what happened. Like, you nailed it. And it's but at the time I was like, well, why would his production go down? Like, nobody could even conceive of the difference between ballparks or any
yeah.
of that stuff.
That's interesting. I didn't remember that at all.
He's played so many good ones.
The players have been talking about the effect of the park since the 1870s. You read 1880s newspapers, you'll see players complaining about their home park. But there wasn't systematic information about it. The information about it wasn't printed anywhere. Like, the Sporting News didn't carry any information about park effect. Fred Lynn in 1979 hit, this is from memory, but he hit around 360 with 27 homers in Fenway, whereas on the road he hit 270 with 12 homers. So, you know, you take him out of Fenway, you can figure there's going to be some effect there. But those numbers were not generally available, and so people didn't understand their impact.
You also said Carney Lansford would hit 310 with 25 homers for Boston. He didn't have the homers, but he hit 339.
Right.
Or 336, sorry.
Right. with only four homers and four ball.
So,
Carney was fun. Carney, if I was sitting in this chair, if Carney was sitting in this chair and a ground ball came right here, he would dive out of his chair in an effort to. Carney dived for everything.
Yeah. So some of the themes that you started banging home for people, I'm checking these so I don't forget anything. Outs need to be avoided at all costs. That seems like a very basic thing, but you were like breaking ground with that in the early 80s.
Perhaps.
On base percentage matters more than batting average.
Right.
That seems like a very basic thing to think, but at the time, people thought you were like crazy.
You started to remind me of, do you ever see this interview with George Carlin, where somebody pulls out his old, George Carlin became famous doing a routine called Hippy Dippy Weatherman on the Ed Sullivan show. It was a weatherman, it was a hippie. Somebody showed it to him later, and he said, wow, I can't believe the kind of material I was getting by with that. The same thing, I can't believe I was getting by with that kind of material. I'm glad I was.
Here's a couple more. Home road splits are more important than people realize.
Okay.
And you were like the first person who made that case. Nolan Ryan was already, said that already. Closers are used incorrectly. Right. Which is something that actually, for even when you took over or started working for the Red Sox in 2003... closers were still used incorrectly. It's getting better.
The way that closers are used is changes every. I mean, we've reached a sort of the way that closers are used and who populates the bullpen was very different in the 1970s than the 1960s. Very different in the 80s than the 70s, and very different in the 90s than the 1980s. In terms of just the closers, we've reached a sort of a resting point. It's sort of stable. The rest of the bullpen is still changes every. I mean, it's still changing very rapidly. It's quite a lot different now than it was 5 years ago. So, you know, to go back and debate whether I was right or wrong at some point in 2003 is, I don't know.
All right.
I'm happy to do it.
Rethinking how we pick Hall of Famers. You were the first one who kind of questioned, why is that guy a Hall of Famer just because he happened to play on 6 World Series teams and was slightly above average?
The Hall of Fame is actually just in the last 2 or 3 years that I've developed a clear idea in my own mind of where to draw the line between a Hall of Famer and non-Hall of Famer. So that's still, but I'd say in the 1970s I was confused about that as everybody else was. But I mean, I had a good excuse because Ron Santo wasn't in the Hall of Fame and guys who were a third as good as Santo were in the Hall of Fame. It's hard to say what is a Hall of Famer. So
after this Sports Illustrated article came out, how did your life change?
Well, after that article came out, I got a book contract from Random House, which enabled me to stop working at 7-Eleven.
So you're working at 7-Eleven this whole time when you're doing these baseball abstracts?
No, not really. I did work at the 7-Eleven. But only for 3 minutes at a time and under a mask. Just kidding. Mostly I was a security guard.
Yeah.
And for a couple of years I was a boiler attendant. And I like to point out that William Faulkner was a boiler attendant when he wrote Sound of the Fury. Not that that's at all arrogant of me. And I did wear other odd jobs, yeah.
And so you were getting all of your box scores just from newspapers? Sporting News?
Sporting News was the best source, yeah.
But they weren't even good box scores back then. They were at-bats, runs, hits, and RBI, and that's it?
That's right. For example, one thing I did early, and again, George Carlin said, I can't believe I was getting by with that kind of material, but I used to count how many stolen bases were allowed by various catchers. Which there was no other data for it. But you couldn't tell because the Sporting News, they wouldn't tell you, the box scores didn't tell you when the stolen base occurred, and they didn't mention caught stealing at all. But so I just did the best I could with the data.
So you were almost like guessing at some points?
No, I wasn't guessing, but I was publishing data that was not exactly the data I would have preferred to be publishing. I would have liked to have data that said exactly. And this was part of, gets back to the Sports Illustrated thing. And this was a long time ago. But it gets back to the Sports Illustrated thing. I would have liked to have data on exactly how many stolen bases were allowed by Johnny Bench and how many guys he threw out. But I didn't have that. So I would count all the games started by Johnny Bench, how many stolen bases there were in those games. And all the games started by his backup, who I think was Pat Corrales or somebody, I don't remember. And then when the Sports Illustrated article was scheduled, we went through a round of objections where people would say the data on stolen bases allowed isn't exactly right because you're just counting it from box scores and some of those bases weren't stolen against Johnny Bench, they were stolen against whoever entered the game in the seventh inning. That's true. I can't argue with you. That is true. If you give me access to the score sheets of the game, which at that time you couldn't get, then I'll count the actual stuff, but just doing the best I can.
I have to ask, there's no way you were using a computer during this time, were you?
We didn't have personal computers, no.
So everything was handwritten,
right. Like
kept in little
notebooks.
Folders and notebooks.
Yeah.
When did you move over to the personal computer?
I enjoyed personal computers as soon as they came out.
I would have guessed.
Yeah, no, I did. But I never could program or anything like that.
Right.
We had a K-Pro. Anybody have a K-Pro?
Yeah.
Clap if you had a K-Pro. Hey!
One clap.
That answers the ancient question. What is the sound of one hand clapping? I had a K-Pro. Had a spreadsheet on it that was 32, it was 32 cells long and 16 wide, I think.
Wow. Great. So what did when did the backlash start against, who is this Bill James? Why is he trying to tell us what does he know? He didn't play. When did that start?
First of all, I made a lot of that stuff worse. I wasn't always nice to people.
Right.
I wish I had been, but I wasn't. I wish I was now, but I'm not always. And sometimes I made that stuff. But I was.
You talking about things you wrote about players and things? Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I was just mean. And I do regret some of that stuff because, you know, they're people. But I was also challenging the way that people thought about the game. People naturally, I mean, what are you going to think? Some guy working in a factory in Kansas says that the guys who have been coaching baseball all their life don't know what they're talking about. What are you going to think?
Right.
So that was what they thought, and they said so.
At the same time, fantasy baseball was starting to gain momentum. Yes. Do you feel like that was playing into this whole? So now you have these two separate worlds that are going on at the same time,
right.
And there's baseball over here that we're not supposed to touch or think about.
And fantasy baseball also being invented by Dan Okren. They were certainly related, but fantasy baseball didn't really hit until 1984. The first 7 or 8 years of the abstract was before fantasy baseball, and then fantasy baseball really hit.
What do you think was the first big stat that you created that you really felt like, wow, this is really good, and I actually feel like this is going to work?
The stolen base counts were huge to me at the time. Another thing that I did in the early days that was interesting, I thought was interesting at the time, people would say, that Jim Palmer paid off his salary by the extra fans that he came out to see him every time he pitched, or that people would say that a lot about Nolan Ryan. So I actually studied what the attendance was with every major league pitcher. Like, take every box score and add up by the starting pitcher what the average attendance was. In 1976, the first year of the abstract, 77, The only pitcher who had any impact on attendance was Mark Fittridge. If you study the data, you could see it's total nonsense. It's just something people like to say. It wasn't true at all. So that was one of the first things I did.
When did you end up at Stats Inc.?
Well, Stats Inc. Didn't exist then.
It was in the 90s.
Right. Well, and I'm a little uncertain of the exact chronology of when all this stuff happened. I know that Dick Kramer, who was running Stats Inc. at that time, in my mind it was like 1982, but I could be off by, you know, who knows. Came and asked if we wanted to invest in Stats Inc. So we did, and John DeWan, and I met John DeWan in 1983, so that this would have been after 1983, took over running Stats Inc., and that company grew from between 1983 and the late 1990s from a two-person startup to a pretty good-sized company that provided stats for thousands of media outlets.
And that must have been, like, for you, all of a sudden you had these people who were kind of thinking on the same plane you were thinking,
right,
bouncing ideas off, stuff like that. I mean, you must have been delighted.
It was wonderful. In a lot of ways, and you can never recreate this, but what was fun about Stats in the 1980s, John DeWan's a really good businessman. And I could say, why don't we do this? And I would meet with him 2 months later, and they'd have a prototype rolled out and ready to go.
Right.
We invented a lot of, like, fantasy-type games and Strat-O-Matic-type games. And I could, like, suggest that computers weren't as complicated then as they are now, so it was in some ways easier to do things. I could propose the handbook. The handbook, which still exists. I was really frustrated that the Sporting News Register didn't come out at that time until, you think I'm making this up, May. they waited until the end of spring training to finalize the rosters to decide who would be in the register. So the Sporting News handbook would come out in May, which isn't real useful for a preseason guide, you know. So I was very frustrated about that, and I proposed to John and Don Zemenda that we do our own register type book, but just flip the switches and do everything that the register did well, we wouldn't try to do, and everything they didn't do well, we would do. For example, they were out in May, we'd come out in November. They didn't include walks and strikeouts, so we would. They included a lot of biographic information, so we wouldn't.
They didn't include walks and strikeouts?
They didn't.
Wow.
Right. That's what I thought.
Those seem like two important categories.
Kind of. Well, they included for pitchers, but they didn't for hitters.
Right.
And they didn't have stolen bases or caught stealing. But anyway, I suggested that to John and Don Zemenda, and then I met with them a month later, and Don had a prototype. Is this the book? And then 2 months after that, the book was on the shelves. It was phenomenal. You've dealt with publishers. Well, maybe you're not old enough, but
I don't like publishers. Publishing
companies were kind of slow sometimes, you know, and trying to deal with big publishing companies, everything has to go through 25 desks before anything gets done.
Yeah.
John and Don were able to get things done, and it was a great thing.
Now, what's really interesting here is you guys are coming up with all this data. I say data for some reason, data. During that decade, that would help teams win if they had followed it. Did you feel like at any point during that decade, all of a sudden maybe there was a GM or two out there who was like secretly kind of reading your stuff and grabbing some of the insight?
Yes, I did have the feeling sometimes, and you wouldn't believe how often anymore I run into some older scout who tells me, you know, I was reading your stuff way back in, I was pitching your stuff to our organization way back in 1979. That happens a lot. And I'm not suggesting they're lying, but they were really quiet about it at the time.
So they, what do you think the stuff they were grabbing was probably like initially like the on-base percentage? Because it's really hard to overstate how important batting average was versus walks. Like, it was almost like I follow Wade Boggs. I'm a big Red Sox fan, obviously. And we looked down on Wade Boggs for taking walks.
Right.
It was like a sign of weakness that he would do this in big moments.
That's
like,
right.
What a jerk. Why isn't he trying to get a hit there? You got to put your bat on the ball. You're our best guy.
Right.
And meanwhile, he was doing the best statistical play.
He was an awfully good player. You're supposed to be Jim Rice. You know, you're supposed to drive the ball and drive in runs. Yeah, that's right.
Right. And Dewey Evans was another one who you just wrote about him for Grantland, but was somebody that the second half of his career and how much he was able to get on base with the power and all that, he was so much better than he was probably considered. He was just known as the guy with a good arm who hit for power.
Right.
And you didn't even really realize all the stuff he was bringing to the table.
That's right.
Or you did, but no, most other people.
He was a very underrated player. That's right.
So when you think about, like, now we're thinking about these guys in Hall of Fame terms, the guys were playing by a certain code in the 70s and 80s because we rewarded them for those things. Like, and now you hear, like, Tim Raines is somebody that gets a ton of Hall of Fame attention now, and I think right. Dwight Evans is another one. But if those guys didn't know that they've kind of stumbled into the right way to play, but then you take somebody like Steve Garvey, who's being rewarded by, I need to drive in runs, I'm our power guy, hey, I don't need to walk here because I got to get my bat on the ball. Like, is that his fault that they didn't know how to play?
Well, no. And Garvey, you know, Tim Raines or Steve Garvey, give me Tim Raines any day.
Right.
But Garvey's like Nolan Ryan on the list of people that I was probably too hard on. You know, he's a great player in his own way. Probably I slowed down my own acceptance as a mainstream writer by overselling the Raines versus Garvey type argument.
Well, go into that a little bit. Slow down your acceptance as a mainstream writer. Like, how did that slow it down if you're stating stuff that's pretty factual?
This is a true story. I'm blanking out on the name, came up with Doug Flynn. One time Doug Flynn became so angry with me that he stopped talking to the media in general. Guys hadn't done anything. I never understood the logic of that, but at least I was told by a couple of Montreal reporters that he was so angry at me he wouldn't talk to any writer. I said, well, what did I say about Doug Flynn? So I went back and looked, and what I had said about Doug Flynn was that he was a horrible excuse for a major league player. And in my own mind, I was just stating the facts, but it was kind of mean.
Right.
It was kind of over the top. And I've tried to take responsibility for my own mistakes as well as, but you know, I don't claim that I was purely objective. Sometimes I was a little more objective than was actually necessary.
How were you received by the media and other writers and stuff in the 80s and early 90s, did you feel like you were like an outcast, or were people like kind of secretly on your side? How did that work?
Well, I had a lot of readers, and there were a lot of people who were nice. There were always a lot of people who were nice and supportive, but they were a minority until about 1989. I remember, I think it was 1989, going to a spring training game in Scottsdale, a Cub spring training game, and I got my credential, and I was sort of I was doing what I usually did, which is trying to be as unobtrusive as possible so that I wouldn't run into anybody that I'd said was a horrible excuse for a Major League Baseball player. And I ran into Harry Carey. Harry was always great to me. He was enthusiastic and greeted me enthusiastically and threw his arm around my shoulder and led me up to the batting cage, and we were talking to Harry, and some young man came up, probably in his early 20s, and started talking to me about, you know, how much he enjoyed my books when he was a young person. He'd now be an old person, but and I realized about 1989 that we were entering it. We'd gone over a bridge somehow.
Right. So you'd say that was maybe the first bridge, and then from probably that point all the way through the 90s, now all of a sudden you have some disciples on their way up, and they're taking some of the work that you had started. Different people are writing. Now it's starting, the army is starting to go this way, but you have the mainstream media here.
Right.
And they're just, they won't have anything to do with it. But that was kind of a fun stretch too, right?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
When was the first, do you remember like when the first like year or so when you realized like, oh man, I have some disciples here. There are people who were like, hey, I read you when I was eight and whatever.
In my own mind, by the way, I was never thought of myself as writing for kids. But I was always able to reach like intelligent kids.
Yeah.
You may have been an intelligent kid yourself.
I
was always able to reach the kids who didn't stop when the sentence got a little complicated. And those were actually were the people who saved my life and reputation in a sense. Once they grew up, was the young people who there were a lot of people in my generation and a lot of people older than me who were nice to me and wrote nice things about me as well. But it was the younger people who really changed things. And I'll mention a couple older people who were always nice to me. Bob Creamer, who wrote The Babe, was always very nice and very supportive. And Roger Angel was always nice and supportive.
I think I was like, growing up reading, I think I was like on the fence because I was playing fantasy with my dad since like 1982, so grabbing any intelligence I could get. And I loved your book for that. On the other hand, you believed in these things that I had been taught to believe was not true.
Right.
And when you're telling me that Wade Boggs is doing the right thing by walking all the time, and I'm thinking like, no, he's not. He's killing us. He's got to swing there and things like that. And it took me, I don't even think until like the early 2000s before I was fully a convert. Like I'd been brainwashed almost by the mainstream philosophies.
Well, I was talking to a class yesterday and I started the class by asking them this question. What is the difference between a religion and a superstition? And I don't mean this in any sense as an anti-religious comment. A superstition is narrow and focused. You believe that if I do this, then this, if I step on this line, something bad will happen to my team. A religion is elaborate and intricate, and it fills in all of the boxes with philosophy, with the wisdom of previous generations, with the wisdom of teachers who went before us, and it's complicated and heals itself. The way that baseball people think about baseball is much more a religion than a superstition. And for that reason, it's much harder to change the way that people think. When you point out that something that people say is not factually true, it's not just like spiking a superstition. It's because it's a religion, something else will move into there. It's a living, interactive system of thought. That creates, I think this is relevant to what you're actually talking about. That it's not just a matter of pointing out that high on-base percentages win. It's a matter of elaborating an entire structural support for that to convince people that you know what you're talking about.
On a scale of 1 to 100, how big was
59?
How big was the internet for everything that happened? I feel like a lot of it would have happened anyway, but the internet enabled people to...
A lot of it wouldn't have happened, yeah. A lot of it would not have happened. And when I was planning what to do with my life and career in the 1970s, I certainly didn't in any way, shape, or form anticipate the internet. But it worked great for me. I was basically blogging before people were blogging.
Right.
And just happened to be in the perfect place to take advantage of that.
Did you ever think about, like, had they had the internet in 1977, all the hours and hours you probably spent clipping box scores,
right,
and filing through microfilm and all this stuff?
I think about it, but the fact that it was so hard was the reason nobody else was doing it. I mean, what I was doing was really simple stuff that if it had been easy, other people would have been doing it. But it was
true.
Hard, so other people weren't doing it.
Oh, that makes sense. So right around 2001, 2002, 2003, Billy Beane becomes the first guy who says, I'm really going to start looking at the inefficiencies here and looking at some of the statistical stuff. Did you feel like other teams were doing that before him and just not making a big deal out of it? Or was he the first?
Yes. No. Yeah, other people were doing it, but just not. He was just more open about it. For some reason, he was not ashamed of it, as all the rest of the guys were.
So who do you think the first team was who actually was really seriously doing this?
Well, I think it was the A's. But it was before Billy Beane. I think the A's were actually studying a lot of the stuff produced by people like me much earlier than 2001.
Did you feel like there was a team in the 90s that took advantage of it that maybe they would never admit that they were doing it, but you were looking at the roster going, this is a team that's doing something here?
Well, the limited ability to answer the question because I can't seem to take credit for somebody else's success. But yeah, there were teams that I thought were doing things well.
Well, give me one.
This would set up the following conversation. I claim that the...
It's just you're an intuition. You're like,
I claim that Altoona was following my leadership in 1985. The general manager of Altoona in 1985 steps forward and says, I never heard of Bill James, and I think he's full of... So let's not go there.
All right. But when Oakland starts with the... what year was that officially? Like 2001?
The movie is set in 2002, but it compresses events that happened over a long period of time.
Yeah. So did you find yourself, were you rooting for them? Did you feel like you had a vested interest? Yeah.
Yeah. But I never had any doubt that the things I was saying were true. I wasn't in any doubt of that. And I always believed that when you're in an argument, it's immensely powerful to have the facts on your side.
Right.
And the I never really had, even if Oakland hadn't succeeded, I don't know that it would have slowed us down too much.
So the next 5 years, basically, from the moment that book came out to, I don't know, it seemed like about 2008 or whatever, the mainstream media finally begrudgingly accepted that this stuff was here to stay. It was a pretty interesting tug of war between the old school and the new school. Did you ever have any doubt you were going to win?
Well, the... the answer would be yes if you added in your lifetime. I always had a lot of confidence that my side of the argument would win, but sometimes you don't know when.
Do you worry, though, that baseball out of all the sports is the one sport that you can literally measure everything to the point that, you know, and I think this is almost why it seems like you're fascinated in crime, because it works a little bit the same way. You're measuring, you know, forensic evidence doesn't lie. Baseball stats really don't lie. Does that remove some of the fun of following baseball if there's a direct answer for everything?
Well, there isn't. I mean, if what you said was true, I don't think I would be fascinated by the sport at all. The fact is that we don't know. I mean, what we don't know, we have all of these stats, but we don't know how they relate to basic questions. I just wrote a big book about crime. I don't know if you guys know it.
You should read it, by the way. It's really good.
Thank you. But in a criminal trial, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of facts, but you don't really know how they relate to the central question of the guilt of the accused. And what is fascinating is to try to construct a bulletproof, I don't know if I should use the expression bulletproof while talking about crime.
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
Logic to assemble the facts in a criminal case as relates to the central question. But baseball is like that. You have these mountains of facts, and the mountains are much higher now than they were when I was doing this stuff, when I started doing this stuff. But you have these mountains of facts, but you're never really sure how they relate to the questions that you're really interested in. Mm. And in the 40 years we've been doing this, we've answered affirmatively and clearly 30 or 40 questions, but there's still several thousand that we haven't gotten to yet.
So if you're a GM now and everybody's using the same stats, and I mean, we saw a couple years ago, Seattle decided there were defensive inefficiencies and they grabbed those, and then everybody caught up on that. And now it's
worked
like,
out great for them, by the way.
Right. Well, it seems like everybody's on to the same inefficiencies now. So now what? Where do we go with front offices?
There's a million things that we don't know. We have succeeded in taking a bucket of ignorance out of a bucket full of knowledge out of an ocean of ignorance, but we don't know anything. I mean, we don't. Nobody can tell you with any confidence what 21-year-old college junior is going to be good and which one isn't. We don't. You know, we don't know whether adding a slider. You know, we don't know whether Daniel Bard is going to be able to make the transition from the bullpen to the starting rotation.
Oh, please,
we
hope
he can.
What's that? I hope he does.
Yeah,
just muttering to myself. Sorry.
Mutter away. I agree. But we don't actually know. Nor do we. So there are always going to be a million things you don't know for everything you actually affirmatively know.
Would you agree that baseball by far is the best sport of all these sports for advanced metrics?
Not really. I mean,
really?
Basketball analysis is far more sophisticated than most people realize. And it's been done for a lot longer, and a lot of ways they're ahead of us in terms of getting their stuff on the floor. It's basketball metrics are a lot more sophisticated.
Are you saying because the basketball box score was better coming out of the gate than baseball? Or?
No. Baseball had that advantage. Baseball had the advantage of having large piles of data in 1975, whereas the data for the other sports was behind it.
Yeah.
But in football, the most serious analysis was always done by the people who were being paid to do it. Football coaches, because of the strength of the college game, football coaches were always organized and intelligent and sophisticated people. And this is going to sound like I'm putting down baseball managers, but the baseball managers of 1975 were a mixed lot. Some of them were really sharp, and I will bleep this for publication, but John Juan was once demonstrating some information for Ozzie Guillen, and he asked Ozzie if he had any information like this when he was playing, and Ozzie said, "No, all we had was a bunch of old leaping drunk guys." Ozzie said that, I didn't. No, you wouldn't have said that about assistant football coaches in 1975. They weren't a bunch of old bleeping drunk guys, whereas baseball coaches, a lot of them were. The sophisticated football has always a film study is analysis. I mean, it doesn't start with stats, but it's the same thing. And so the other sports have always been doing some sophisticated study, kind of inside the game.
But in basketball, I think it's so hard because you have five guys who have to relate to each other at the same time that they're doing the stats. And in baseball, you have nine guys who don't really relate to each other at all, which is the easiest thing to measure. Football, I think, is pretty tough because, I mean, at that point, it depends on the offensive line, how many times you've been used. Like, especially, I mean, did you ever think about, man, now I've conquered baseball. Now I'm going to go here and try
I think that, but I can't do it. By the way, I much enjoyed your. What's the name of your big basketball book?
Book of Basketball. Yeah, well,
that's why I can't remember the name. I much enjoy. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful read. But one reason the basketball analysis is as sophisticated as it is that you have to be pretty sharp to analyze basketball. It ain't easy.
I mean,
it is easier to do entry-level analysis on baseball. Basketball's kind of tough. But because of that, the people who do it are pretty sharp.
Did it? You're a man of fact. You're a man of truth. You're a man who likes things to make sense. Moneyball, the movie, was loaded with inaccuracies. Did that bug you at all?
Not at all.
Not at all? Okay. Because it was a movie.
It's a movie. They took events over a long period of time and compressed them into a short period of time. And there's some anachronisms but hey, they were awfully nice to me, so I'm not complaining.
What actor were you hoping that they were going to cast for you? You ended up. They showed your picture. You didn't actually have the
right. Actor. There was no. There was talk about what's his name, Giamatti's son. That was talked about for a while. I think he's a little guy. So I was hoping for Sean Connery, but
that would have been interesting. So when that came out, did you feel like kind of that was the culmination of all this stuff? Now here's this movie that comes out. It's basically about this movement that you started, and then people liked the movie, and I think it got nominated for an Oscar. Brad Pitt did.
It was nominated for Best Picture.
Was that the culmination of this 30-year journey, basically?
Well, yes, but no more so than this conference. I mean, my professional career has been a long cessation of good breaks.
Yeah.
I've always been. It was people ask me when the Red Sox won in 2004. Do you feel that this justifies your work? Well, yes, but you know, no more so than I thrilled the Red Sox won in 2004, and I think I enjoyed 2007 more because you know I've been a Red Sox fan longer. My career has I've always been fortunate. I've always been in the right place at the right time, and so this is like they make a movie in which I'm there, and it turns out to be a really good movie, and a movie that everybody sees and everybody likes, and my wife says, of course it is, you know, because I've always been lucky that way. I don't know why.
See, I would argue that you weren't in the right place at the right time in the late 70s because you had, 4 years there where right. You just had to have the faith that what you were doing was eventually going to pay off. I think most people probably would have quit at that point.
Was it only 4 years?
Well, you released 4.5 abstracts right. Before that Sports Illustrated article.
I think that's right.
And had you made, like, what? Had you made $10,000 from those 4 years of books?
Not even that, yeah.
Yeah. So I think you should give yourself credit for that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. But you know as a writer that you can't stop doing what you do. You know,
yeah, that's true.
You got to do this. So.
Right. The Red Sox in 04, it was the sabermetrics that Theo and the staff use overrated, underrated, or properly rated for how that team was built?
Well, we weren't underrated.
Just like what the impact was that people thought the impact was it?
Yeah.
Was it fair that it was had a big impact, or was some of it luck, like David Ortiz was on the scrap heap?
Yeah, I mean, this is really true. When we signed David Ortiz, there was a guy named Brad Fulmer. Do any of you guys remember Brad Fulmer? If you look at him back before 2003, Brad Fulmer and David Ortiz look a lot the same. And the reason we signed David Ortiz rather than Brad Fulmer is Minnesota released David Ortiz at the right time for us.
Mm.
We could just as easily have signed Brad Fulmer. A lot of it was luck, and Theo's an awfully bright guy, and he gets he deserves the credit that he gets for it, and I'm happy to receive my portion of the credit for it. But you know, realistically, yeah, it's the players who win it.
I don't know if it would have felt good to call Brad Fulmer Big Poppy.
Right.
I think that would have been weird. I don't know if I could have gotten used to that.
I don't know. Could we come up with a nickname for
him? Yeah. This crime book that you wrote.
Yeah.
How many years did you spend working on this?
Well, there literally are pieces in that book that I wrote in the 1980s. Probably there may be pieces in there I wrote in the 1970s, because every time I finished an abstract. I thought, this isn't going anywhere, so I'm going to do something else. But then I'd go back to it. There are pieces in the crime book that I wrote, I know, in as early as 1984.
That book sent me to a really weird place. I'm sure you've gotten that before. You start reading about crime after crime after crime, and
right.
I was like, all right, one more. I'm like, oh, Ted Bundy's coming. And keep going, and then all of a sudden it's another 100 pages, and you're half asleep, and serial killers are in your head. Like, yeah. It wasn't good. I was glad I finished it. I was glad to get rid of it. But, you spend all your time doing that. I feel like you need to write about crimes for Grantland now, because there are new ones that are coming out that you
right.
didn't cover in your book,
right.
like Kaylee Anthony.
There's,
I would wonder your take on that.
Right.
Or who is it? There was the one, Amanda Knox. That's another one you need to write about.
I appreciate the invitation. I'll write something for you about crime.
Because you can't give up on crime after you did this whole Odyssey.
There's no shortage of it.
What was your single favorite? Because I know in the book it seemed like you enjoyed the OJ the most. Am I wrong? Like just for the science of it and the whole thing, or was there another one?
I don't know. There's some stories that really get fascinated by, and others. I don't know. I wouldn't say I was an OJ file, no.
Oh, you wouldn't?
No.
How many pages did you do on the OJ?
Not that many.
Or maybe I'm thinking of JFK. Was JFK like?
I did write a lot about
that's
JFK.
You had a whole interesting theory about JFK.
OJ killed him.
I don't know if you guys have heard this one. OJ killed him. That you believe that the Secret Service in the car behind.
I think it's possible. There was a book written by a man named Bonar Menninger, whose theory was that Lee Harvey Oswald did in fact shoot the president, but that what actually killed him was an accidental misfire from a Secret Service agent. Sounds like a nutty theory, right? When you try to find where specifically he's wrong, it's hard to find. I can't find where specifically his theory is wrong.
It was the guy in the car behind him.
Yeah.
And at some point, and then you go on the YouTube and there's like a whole thing about how the Zapruder film was doctored. It didn't come out for five years.
Those people are crazy.
I love it.
And you have no idea how many films there are related to the Kennedy assassination. Until you go on YouTube, people know the Zapruder film, but there are like 25 films related to that. Of course, a lot of them end like, one of them ends at the moment of the first shot. One of them ends at like 5 minutes before they reach Dealey Plaza. But there are a lot of interesting films related to that.
Mm. So you have all these people here. I think we had like, 2,200?
At the convention?
Yeah. And I'm sure the question you get asked the most is, do you have any advice for me? How do I get to where you got? Like, how do you even answer a question like that?
That's a tough one. There are lots of opportunities now. I mean, there are lots of... The best answer I can give you is you have to know something that not everybody knows. There are jobs in all sports. The key to getting one of them is that you have to know something that not everybody else knows. And that the team wants to know. If you can do that, you got a shot.
Yeah, because as you said earlier, in the late 70s, nobody else wanted to go through every box score and compile that. So you had a competitive advantage because you were doing all of this work.
Right.
So now it would seem like, this is when people ask me here, like, what do you think I should do? How do I get toward for a team? Like, don't do the thing that 270 other people are doing. Do the thing that no person is doing.
Right.
I don't know what that is. So that's where my advice, the train kind of goes off the tracks. But there's got to be stuff out there that teams haven't thought of yet.
There's
a
million things. There's a million things people haven't thought of doing.
Also seems like, I think teams are eventually going to get to the point where every team has just a bureau of stats and research guys.
That's right.
And some of them have already started. Houston has invested heavily, obviously the Rockets, but I think we're going to get to a point where every team has six or seven people on staff and those jobs multiply.
If you're going to play a baseball player, and we pay people, this is not an exaggeration, we pay people enough money every day to buy a house. If you're going to pay people at that level, to play baseball, it becomes really important that you make good decisions about them.
You'd think.
So you can buy a lot of guys like us for what it costs for one Manny Ramirez. It just makes sense that it will continue, that the search for information will continue to grow.
I forgot to ask you about the Hall of Fame and the PED area, obviously, which you get asked about all the time. But you've been pretty vocal about judging people by the fact that they were in this era, and a lot of people cheated, and that was just part of what the era is, no different than the tall mound and another era, or the fact that, you know, pre-1947, nobody was playing against black players. Like, this was just part of what made this era this era.
Right.
Was that a controversial opinion? Did you take heat for that?
Well,
how did people react?
I mean, I take heat for everything I write. I don't mind. I don't see the players as cheating. I mean, I know people do see it that way, but they just wanted to be better baseball players, right? And there wasn't any system of enforcing rules against performance-enhancing drugs. It's very debatable whether there were any rules against performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, the commissioner had authored some vague edict. There are certain characteristics that a rule has. It's specific. It outlines the conduct it prohibits. It's agreed upon by some sort of process. It outlines the prohibitions. People who think there was a rule against the use of PEDs want to ignore the fact that there was no process associated. There was just this. There weren't any penalties for the use of PEDs. There wasn't any process to investigate whether people were using PEDs. There weren't any specific list of things you couldn't use. They weren't cheating. They were just trying to be as good baseball players as they could be. And that's the way I see it. And I don't look down on them we all wish it hadn't happened. We all wish baseball had gotten on top of this issue in 1975, or that failing 1985. It didn't happen. It got out of control. Wish it didn't, but here we are.
And I mean, at least for the pre-2003 guys, as you said, there were no rules in place.
Right.
I mean, now I think it's a little worse. If you're doing it now, all the stuff now.
If you're doing it now, you're cheating. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was more of a spirit of the game type thing. But think of all the different edges that athletes try to get, and this was one of the edges. I'm with you. Yeah. I think there's so many of these guys that I guess it's like, what do we want out of the Hall of Fame? Like, for me, it's like, my son's 4.5. Hopefully he'll like baseball and not Angry Birds at some point in his life. And if I took him to Cooperstown and I had a weekend to teach him about baseball, I don't understand how Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire couldn't be in there.
Right.
That's just insane. It's a museum.
Right.
So to just say, no, these guys can't go, then what are we trying to accomplish?
Well, that's right. And if you ban those guys from Hall of Fame, do you throw out the world championship I mean, every team that won a world championship between 1993 and 2004 had a bunch of steroid users on it. Do those not count? Are those world championships not real?
Right.
I don't know.
2004, you had to say that. You could have stopped at 2003. Easily, it would have been 1 year. You could have chopped it out.
That's true.
You said 1975, 1985. This is something that I've always wondered. Because there seems to be this mindset that, oh, in 1992, steroids magically appeared in baseball, and yet we know that it went back to the 1970s in football.
Right.
How do we know that? You know, I remember, like, in the late 70s, people in baseball, there was a big Nautilus run. Remember that year? Everybody's like, oh, I did Nautilus. And
right.
There was a big power boom. How do we know baseball players weren't using steroids in 1974?
Right. You said it went back to the 70s in football, but I live in the town I live in, John Hadle, who was the NFL MVP about 1965 or something. He also lives in Lawrence, where I live, so we wind up on panels together once in a while. And John says when he reported to the San Diego Chargers for the first time, there was a a jar of steroids on the training table. This was, I don't know, early 1960s.
Yeah.
I've had high school football players tell me that they were required by their coaches to use steroids in the late 1970s. It goes back a long way.
Yeah. So why are we so anxious to judge the 1990s on? I mean, yeah. You could basically go through and maybe that'll be your next book. Bill James, congrats on everything. I certainly do not think that this conference would exist if not for everything you did once upon a time and continue to do. Thank you for being the first ever guest for the live audience BS report.
All right. Thanks. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.